You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. This is the American Hour. Welcome. And, of course, my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon Osman, is with me today. I'm broadcasting from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and she's broadcasting from Boston, Massachusetts. How are you today, Paula?
Doing great, Tom. It's 70 and mostly sunny up here in Boston. Really nice, beautiful day.
Good. Well, that's about how it is down here in Sao Paulo. To me, that's chilly. That's cold. Too cold. But that's why I'm not going to be flying here anymore, at least, when you need to change your schedule around, the nice thing about being an airline pilot is I can trade around and fly different places. But right now, I'm scheduled to fly to Madrid all next month, and I'm really looking forward to that because the weather's going to be nice. But, it's not too bad here, and we got in a little bit early this morning. And so people need to understand that broadcasting from down here sometimes can have its glitches, and I heard a siren going by a little while ago, and sometimes it gets noisy. We're on a major thoroughfare right here, but fortunately, very civil people here in Sao Paulo, Brazil. They're not honking their horns all the time. And I am at the wonderful Grand Pullman Hotel in Sao Paulo. For the most part of this month, we've been broadcasting from the Caesar Business. Well, the Grand Pullman is much nicer. I'm glad I'm here. And then word is that we're back at the Caesar Business for next month. So I'm glad I'm not going to be coming back. As much as I like things here in Sao Paulo, I'm going to be really looking forward to Madrid and getting out and getting some good, great food there in town, walking around and enjoying the weather. In any case, that's what's going on here. There's a lot in the news, and we want to get rid of a few administrative things, get a few administrative things out of the way right now. Number one, I was at the Tycho Air Museum this weekend for Memorial Day weekend and had a lovely time with some of my fellow colleagues, aviators, fighter pilots, helicopter pilots, you name it, that are members of the Valiant Air Command there. And we had a pretty big turnout for the Memorial Day weekend of folks coming to the open house, and I had not seen the new hangar there yet, which is dedicated to Vietnam warbirds. So we've moved all of our Vietnam warbirds over into the new hangar, which is really big and nice, and that made more room. And so the F-14, which is where I normally stand and answer questions of people and talk with folks, there used to be an F-8 Crusader right next to that, but that was moved into the Vietnam hangar. So guess which airplane is now sitting next to the F-14, Paula?
Oh, I don't know.
I know. I didn't expect you to know that. But why would anybody know unless they've been there?
Blue Angel?
An F-18.
Yep.
Yeah,
I get Blue, here in the picture.
It's the Blue Angel jet. Yeah. I didn't put a picture on Facebook, but people need to go to Facebook page, the American Hour, the American Hour radio show page, and I put a few photos up there. First of all, me standing next to my favorite F-14. It's my favorite F-14 because, well, I'm a member of the Valiant Air Command there, and we roll it out for the air show, and it's always a very popular airplane. But right next to it now is a Blue Angel FA-18. I did not fly in the Blue Angels, but I did fly the FA-18. So I can stand kind of between those two airplanes and talk to people about both of them. And so that's fun for me. And there was a little bit of flying. There were a few folks there that were doing some flying. We had a B-27, the Tycho Bell, that was giving rides. It went out on one flight. We loaded up about 9 people. Of course, you have to pay, but it's worth it to get on that airplane. And they flew around and took a pretty long flight. And then there was a gentleman there that had a biplane that was giving rides. I think that was like $75 to get a ride on the biplane. And people were having a good time and enjoying seeing the airplanes and talking with us. Of course, it was a pretty hot day, and not too many of our aviator members were wearing their flight suits. I wore mine. Terry Yon, who's sort of the PR guy and a real linchpin for the Air Command, had his flight suit on. But It was a hot day. Well, that's the way it is. When I was flying in the Navy, we frequently went places, whether it be Key West, El Centro, California, Yuma, Arizona, where it could be quite hot, and you'd be wearing your flight suit all day long. And then when you're going flying, you're putting your flight gear on. Some of the old airplanes we flew didn't have any had air conditioning. It works when you're up in the air and you're going fast. When you're on the ground, there's no air conditioning, so it could be quite hot. But in any case, it was a fun weekend. Had a good time. So go to the Facebook page, and you'll see a couple photos that I put up there. One is of a photo. It's Hiram Mann and another gentleman getting congressional gold medals for their service in the military and their service as fighter pilots in the military. And that was taken in 2007. The other photo is Hiram Mann sitting there inside the museum where we've got all kinds of memorabilia and photos and pieces of equipment, et cetera. So we got airplanes out in the hangar and airplanes in the next hangar, and then we've got a whole sort of museum portion. Well, he goes over and sits in an area that's actually dedicated to him and the Tuskegee Airmen. He was one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. A fighter pilot, flew 48 missions in World War II over France and Italy, and got some great stories. Well, I've met him before, and I put a picture of him on there. I've got some pictures on my personal Facebook page, I believe, with me kneeling down next to him, but he's going to be on the show next week. We haven't scheduled the date, so keep an eye out for that. We will advertise on Facebook, but what a wonderful guy, what a gentleman. He's been married for 70 years to the same woman. He's 90 years old, and boy, he's sharp as a tack, and he's so much fun to talk with and just listen to his story. So he's always a big hit. Usually I know when he's in the museum, if I come in for a little break or to get some water, I see a big crowd of people over in the corner. I know that Hiram's there talking with folks, and he appeals to young and old. I mean, the kids, you see these little kids that just are listening to his stories, loving it, and of course, older people too, as well, adults as well. So he'll be on the show next week, God permitting. We'll see if you know what he's feeling up to. I've always never seen him, but anything but in good health. He's pretty much in a wheelchair now, but he's sharp as a tack, and we'll get him on the show next week. So keep an eye out for that. But go to the Facebook page, and you'll also see a third picture. I took a few other pictures, but you know, it's like a family album. Who wants to see all those pictures? But you will get to see me standing next to an F-14, and yes, I'm wearing one of my original flight suits. I can still fit into it. Not as slender as I used to be, because you can look at some of the other photos on the site and see that same flight suit. There's a photo of me standing next to a camouflaged F-18, and you'll see that I don't fill that flight suit out quite as much as I do now. But it's not like I'm, you know, doing too bad. Consider that I'm 50, so anyway. So that's there. And when you go to the Facebook page, if you haven't clicked on the like button, please do that. Click on that like button. We like it when people like us, and it helps with advertising and support when we can show that we've got, you know, more and more people following us. So please do that. Our good friend Joan Flowers had a birthday on Sunday, and I don't remember if we mentioned that yesterday on Memorial Day weekend. We had a pretty action-packed day, but Joan Flowers, if you go to our April 19th show, you can hear about Joan and her father, and we're continuing to work on getting her father, who was a World War II veteran and war hero, into the Arlington Cemetery, and we'll keep you updated on that. But we're working on that. Joan Flowers, and of course, Joan Flowers has a wonderful, silky smooth voice. If you need any voiceover work, if you know anybody that does, you got to hire Joan, because she has a fantastic voice. If you're in the Chicago area, she also does acting, et cetera, and she really can use the work right now, because she spent a lot of her own time and money over the years chasing down, trying to get her father put into Arlington. It hasn't been easy, and she's had some promises. Bill Clinton promised her that he would be, and then imagine that didn't come through on that. I've seen the paperwork and documentation. Bill Clinton did promise, or his administration promised her, that her father would be buried in Arlington, and it didn't happen. So we're going to continue to work that until we achieve that. Let's see. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting here out of Sao Paulo again, and then the next couple days we'll be broadcasting out of Florida and Boston. And just a programming note, because of the summer and summer things going on and the opportunity to travel and do some other things, we're going to scale back to broadcasting on Monday and Wednesday. We're going to give it a try. If we get a lot of complaints, we'll go back to more days of the week. But for now, I think we can give you some quality, and we may ramp up the show. Paula, it just occurred to me, we didn't talk about this, but we may ramp the show up to a couple hours. versus just 1 hour. In fact, we may have to do that if we're only going to do it on Monday and Wednesday. But that's the plan right now, so just keep an eye out for that on the website. We'll announce on Facebook, but the website, USARadioNetwork.com or USATalkRadioNetwork.com, both of those will get you to our website, and we'll list the hours there. And, of course, we have some other great hosts on our network. Steve Rosenblum with Conservative Republican Forum. You don't want to miss him. He's broadcasting right now every day at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. And then on Saturday, he gets some fantastic guests on there. 6 p.m. broadcast. You don't want to miss that. And he's one of the top broadcasters there broadcasting on Blog Talk. And let's see, Michael Cutler, sounds like he may be joining us pretty soon. If you saw the show from last Monday, he was a guest, and then he filled in for me as a host along with Paula on Thursday. Great guy. We want to get him broadcasting here, and we may be able to do that here pretty soon. It sounds like he may be ready, and he'll be broadcasting on Friday at 7 p.m. And then, of course, we've got Bella D'Angelo. You can link to where her site is from our network site, and she was broadcasting every day. I don't know if she scaled that back a little bit because she changed jobs, but she's always great to listen to. And we got, Michael Ross, I believe, yes, on the network. Don't miss his show on Sundays at 3 p.m. And let's see, what else? Anything else we need to talk about before we get into the latest news, Paula?
Not that I'm aware of. Take it away.
Okay. All right, it's time to hammer Debbie What's-Her-Name Schultz, except I have a new name for her. Her new name is Debbie What's-My-Next-Lie Schultz. We've talked a little bit about her the last week or so because we've had two candidates on that are running against her in Florida's District 20. She's now the new chairman of the DNC, the Democrat National Committee, but she's still a congresswoman, and she's going to run to remain a congresswoman and fill the role of DNC chairman. So Karen Harrington last week told us that she doesn't do her job as a congresswoman very well. She's really going to do a bad job trying to be a congresswoman and chair of the DNC. That's good for us. That's good for us conservatives out there, whether you're an independent or Republican or whatever your party affiliation. If you're a conservative and believe in the Constitution and the rule of law, then you want to see Debbie Wasserman Schultz defeated in her congressional seat and do a lousy job as the chair of the DNC, which she's already doing. Now, it's interesting to note, last week we talked about how she was using the Ten Commandments, to politicize the rhetoric and whatever else between Republicans and Democrats. And what she said is, to a group of Democrats, she said that the ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not bear false witness. And if anybody is bearing false witness about a Democrat or Democrats, we want you to hold them accountable. See, Debbie is really, very religious, and she really believes in the Ten Commandments and would not want a Republican to bear false witness against the Democrat. That's one of her top concerns, a Republican bearing false witness. That's her top concern as a commandment. Of the Ten Commandments, number nine, bearing false witness. That's just a top priority for her. Unfortunately, number six isn't much of a priority for her, thou shalt not kill, because she's a huge abortion proponent. The bottom line is this, she's a hypocrite. She wants to selectively use something like the Ten Commandments. And by the way, politicizing the Ten Commandments, I think it's just poor, poor taste. But she'll selectively choose one to utilize in some little thing about controlling rhetoric between two parties. But she'll absolutely ignore it when it comes to abortion and abortion on demand in the United States. In any case, well, what else do we have about Debbie? We're going to actually play a clip from her. And Paul, I think it may be the only time we ever play a voice clip from Debbie What's-Her-Next-Lie Schultz, because it's hard to listen to her. It really is. And she's not too abrasive in this, but frequently when I see her doing a interview, she just comes across as very abrasive. And I also went through this thing and looked at her response. There's a lot of, I think. I mean, I see it all through this article and her talking. I think. She doesn't seem to know much, but she thinks a lot. Boy, she's a real thinker. Anyway, this is a sound clip that came – it was put out today, but I believe it goes back to like a week or so ago. It was the Christian Science Monitor breakfast, May 26th. And she's going to talk a little bit about illegal immigration and that the Republicans believe illegal immigration should be a crime. We believe it should be a crime? All right. So we're going to get to her lies here in a minute, but I'm going to play the sound clip so you can hear her say it herself. And if you have any small children around, you might want to cover their ears. But here we go. Debbie, what's your next slide, Schultz, on illegal immigration?
His position, Democrats' position, is that we need comprehensive immigration reform. We have 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country that are part of the backbone of our economy, and that is not only a reality but a necessity, and that it would be harmful if the Republican solutions that I've seen in the last 2 years is that we should just pack them all up and ship them back to their own countries, and in fact that it should be a crime, and we should arrest them all. I mean, that was in legislation that Jim Sensenbrenner advanced. If it were up to the candidates running for president on the Republican side, we would be driving foreign cars. They would have let the automobile industry in America go down the tube.
I assume that you think it's going to be an issue in the coming campaign. I understand that the...
Well, I think the Republicans are going to certainly attempt to make it an issue. They attempted to make it an issue in 2008.
Well, the Republican Jewish Coalition had its report in the New York Times this morning, Pat Brooks, saying that you were proposing a gag order on the subject.
Yeah, well, I take... one of the most tremendous sources of pride for me is that I am the first Jewish woman to represent the state of Florida.
Well, there's just so much in that, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, first of all, she said that illegal immigrants are the backbone of our economy, and they're a necessity. In fact, if we somehow could magically make all of the illegal immigrants, the 12 illegal immigrants that she talked about here in the country, suddenly just go away or just not be here, the economy apparently would collapse, according to Debbie Wasserman Schultz. They're the backbone of our economy and a necessity. Can you believe that, Paula? I mean, that's
not
an outrageous, ridiculous thing.
Not for nothing, but you might want to find out who's cleaning her house.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Who's cleaning her house? Okay. She had to throw that little sound thing in there about, and we talked about that last week, but about Republicans wanted to just let the car companies go under instead of bailing them out. And if Republicans could have their way, we'd all be driving foreign cars. No, Republicans don't want us driving foreign cars. Just Republicans want us buying cars that aren't subsidized by the American taxpayer and,
right.
Have quality and are a reasonable price. You know, so that's fine. I'm not going to say that American car makers don't make nice cars, and there's some really nice cars that they make. But she's saying that we would like – Republicans want Americans to drive foreign cars. I don't want that at all. I'd like Americans to drive nothing but American cars, except Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the hypocrite that she is, drives an Infiniti. Okay. So that's that little piece in there. But then she said Republican solution – now here's line number two. The Republican solution is to pack up, arrest illegal immigrants en masse, and deport them. I've never seen one Republican propose that, ever, ever. Now, she cites in the article, let me make sure I find the right article here. She cites in the article that this Republican congressman from Wisconsin, here's what he said. So, in other words, let me back up. This Republican solution is to pack them up and ship them out and arrest them. Well, first of all, they've broken the law. Okay, so line number two is Republican solution, and no Republican has ever proposed that. Line number three is that Representative James Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin, proposed that. And here's what she said. In 2006, he proposed a bill that would increase border enforcement. Oh, that's really bad. Border enforcement? Bad for him. Bad, 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 James. You can't be doing that. And make illegal immigration a criminal offense instead of a civil matter. There's line number – I have lost track now. Are we up to four now? Three or four? Three is that he did just this, proposed pack them up. That's line number three. Line number four is that we would make it a criminal offense instead of a civil matter. This is what she said, a criminal offense instead of a civil matter. All right. Well, let's just read to you from Title 8, Section 1325 of the U.S. Code, improper entry by an alien, any citizen of any country other than the United States who attempts to enter to the United States at any time or place than as designated by immigration officers, or eludes examination or inspection by immigration officer, or attempts to enter or obtains entry to the United States by a willfully false or misleading representation or the willful concealment of material fact, has committed a federal crime. A federal crime. But Debbie Wasserman Schultz said that Republicans want to make it a crime instead of the civil matter that it is. There's lie number four. It's not a civil matter. It's a criminal offense, and it's a federal criminal offense. Okay, so let's take a look at the bill that Congressman Sensenbrenner put together. And I'm going to read it to you, the highlights of it. Securing our border. Now, that's a really bad one. Holding employers accountable for hiring illegal immigrants. The president himself has said we've got to do that. Of course, he's not going to do it, but he said we've got to do it. Cracking down on fraudulent forms of identification makes it more difficult for illegal immigrants to create fraudulent visas and other forms of identification. See, Debbie would like to just say, no, let them do it. Come on, give them a break. What happens if I create a false driver's license and a false Visa card and go buy stuff at Walmart? I'm going to jail for that. But when illegal immigrants use documents to steal our citizenship, oh, no, that's not that big a deal, according to Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Eliminating the distorted system of congressional allotment changes the current system, which counts illegal immigrants as part of the total population when determining the number of congressional districts. Ensuring temporary agriculture workers remain temporary. In other words, temporary agriculture workers that come in on an H-2A visa, in order to ensure they don't overstay, can't bring their family members with them. So apparently now they can bring their family members, and of course once they got their whole family here because they came in on a temporary work visa, guess what? They kind of melt into the system. Doubling the number of H-1B visas increases the quantity of H-1B visas for skilled workers to 130,000 and increases penalties for illegal immigrant smuggling. Now there you have it. I mean, is there anybody out there that thinks one of these coyotes that is bringing illegal immigrants across in dangerous quantity and trucks with no air conditioning, et cetera, shouldn't, you know, get in some trouble? And the congressman says, establish mandatory minimum sentences of 1 year for those caught smuggling illegal immigrants into the U.S. Now, in this bill that I just read, the highlights, did you hear anywhere, Paul, because I didn't hear it, anywhere that said that we're going to pack them up and ship them out?
No.
No. It's just enforcing existing law. See, here's what the Republican proposal is. Enforce existing law, crack down on employers. Illegal immigrants can't get jobs here. They can't get a driver's license. They can't hide in a sanctuary city. They go back. They had no trouble getting here. We didn't have to ship them here. Nobody had to ship them here. They came here on their own.
Right.
So how about we let them go back on their own? They go back on their own when there's nothing here for them. Now, some people are going to say, oh, Tom, you're a racist. Hey, remember, my name is Garcia. I'm going to make this as plain and as clear as I can. When I come into my kitchen and find that ants have gotten in the house because there's some spillage in a cabinet, there's something there for them, and they're going to keep coming. I can get the spray out, and I can be mean, you know, and spray the little ants and squash them and other things. They'll just keep coming back because there's something there for them. If I clean up the cabinet so there's nothing there for them, I never have to harm a single little ant. Not a single little ant. They just leave because there's nothing there for them.
Right.
People like Debbie Wasserman Schultz has created a place where there's something here for them. Sanctuary cities, looking the other way, telling immigration and border security officers to don't arrest illegals, you know, and then telling the state of Arizona it can't enforce its borders and try and stop the massive amount of crime that has come in there in the last 20 years. I lived there 20 years. Well, I haven't been there and lived there for like, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 years. I'm losing track here, but the last time I was there was maybe 15, 17 years ago. And it has changed. I haven't been there, but my cousins still live there, and I have friends that are in law enforcement there, and they all tell me the same thing. Tom, you wouldn't recognize it when you come back. Crime has really gotten bad. Not that there's more of it. It's just much worse. And it's all because of the illegal immigration. That's what is behind it all. So when Debbie Wasserman Schultz said that illegal immigrants are the backbone of our economy and our nation, no, they're a huge, massive, festering sore on our nation, and they're costing this nation billions and billions of dollars, as Michael Cutler, the 30-year INS officer that we just talked about, attested to last week when he was on the show. So there's four or five lies for you right there in a row, and let's just see what else Debbie, what's your next lie going to be, Schultz else had to say. Now, you notice when I played the clip, I brought it to the end where the gentleman interviewing her said, some Jewish coalition said that she's going to try and put forward a gag order. Because remember, she said in 2008, the Republicans tried making illegal immigration an issue. Wow. Tried making an issue. Nobody has to try and make it an issue. It's a huge issue if you live in the Southwest. It's a huge issue in our nation. When you look at the amount of money it's costing us, whether it be in emergency rooms, and crime in certain parts of the country, in certain states, and the money that flows out, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to other countries because of illegal immigrants sending the money home. That's really where they come here to work and get money and send it home. So it's a great cash flow for other countries that have high numbers of illegal immigrants here. So she wants to put a gag order on the subject of illegal immigration. In other words, Republicans can't talk about it in this upcoming presidential campaign. Can you believe that? This is an issue that's of supreme importance, that's quite important, big importance to many states and Americans in general. It is of importance because it's an issue. It's a serious issue. More American citizens die at the hands of illegal immigrants every year than in just 1 year than in the first 8 years in Iraq. First whole years, 8 years in Iraq, more Americans die in 1 year, and that's year after year after year. So we think, oh, we're losing soldiers. We want the troops to come home. We absolutely do. We're losing more Americans here at home in another war. It's called illegal immigration. But she doesn't want – she wants it to be considered a civil matter, and it's not – okay, so a gag order so we can't – well, you know what? I want a gag order on Obamacare so that they can't talk about it. Or I want a gag order on what's one of their big issues? Oh, racism. Yeah, they love using the race card. I want a gag order on racism. Can't talk about racism. Can't talk about it. Well, the bottom line is this is the tactics that the Democrats are going to use. They've clearly telegraphed what they're going to do by hiring somebody like Debbie What's-Her-Next-Lie Schultz to be their chairman. They're going to lie, lie, lie. And remember, when it came to immigration, that article that Michael Cutler wrote a few weeks ago, which said, if at first you don't succeed, that's like with comprehensive immigration reform, we'll call it actually amnesty, that's really what it is, lie, lie again. If at first you don't succeed, lie, lie again. And this is the road, they're the path that they're going down. So at the end of that, where she got asked about the gag order, caught her off guard, you could tell. And so what did she do? Did she continue to talk about the subject and say, yeah, this is unreasonable to keep arguing about immigration reform. It's diverting us from other important, you know, whatever it is, or we don't want to allow the Republicans to have a tool to make us look bad. That's the real reason. What did she do? She changed the subject. Well, you know, one of the things I'm so most proud of is the fact that, you know, I'm the first Jewish woman in Florida to represent in Congress. Debbie, we really don't give a flying, you know what? We really don't. We're really glad that you're a woman and, you know, we're getting more women in Congress and you even happen to be Jewish. The fact she had to throw the Jewish thing in there, I think, is, wait a minute. Saying that we got more women going to Congress is great. My representative is a woman. It's great. But we got to now throw our ethnic background into it. The DNC is just a bunch of race baiters. They'll use race and ethnicity and religion and other things just to stir the pot and turn things. So when they say that Republicans are the true racist, they're the ones that are always bringing up this kind of stuff. But, yeah, she didn't want to answer that about the gag order because it was going to make her look bad, so she completely changed the subject like a typical politician. And then what did she have to change it to? Herself. I'm so proud to be the first woman. You know what? If I had gotten elected to Congress when I ran, do you think I would have ever stood there in front of any group and say, I'm really proud to be the first Hispanic heritage fighter pilot to ever serve in Congress for the state of Florida? First of all, I didn't go around using the word I all the time. Now, in conversations like this, you kind of have to. But when I gave speeches, it was us, we. And one of my good friends who was on the show a few months ago, Dion Long, he was in that same race. And I didn't know him before that, but we became good friends. I remember watching him give some pretty good speeches where he never said the word I, never said the word me in his speech, just the way I was doing it as well. But then you watch somebody like Debbie What's-My-Next-Lie Schultz, and I, look, I mean, what I think is unfortunate, what I suggested among others, including members of the Republican Jewish Coalition, is I, me. So when she has to change the subject, she can't change it to anything of substantive value. She changes it to herself and how proud she is of herself. Wow.
Yeah.
So there we have it. Oh, and let's see if there's any comments from people on this. I didn't actually look before.
No, I haven't.
Let's see. Yeah. So Debbie Wasserman believes that all illegal aliens that do not pay enough taxes to cover even 20% of their cost and that have no education are necessary and important to our economy and country. By that insane logic, we should bring another 50 or 100 million in. Yeah, really. I mean, if they're the backbone of our economy, we can't live without them, yet they don't contribute, and they only really suck from out of our system, wow, we could totally destroy our country if we would just double up on illegal immigrants. I mean, they never make sense. And, of course, when she makes a statement like this, the backbone of our economy and they're a necessity, she can say that all day. She can say that all she wants. There's no valid proof for that. So this gentleman who made a comment, who threw some numbers out there, and I don't know where he got it, but he's just saying they don't pay enough taxes to cover even 20% of their own cost, whether it's education for their children, health care, et cetera. Wasserman should go to Honduras and sneak across the Mexican border, see how treated by Mexico. Yeah, exactly. You are a criminal. You get caught like that, you're going to jail and fined. So she wants to give these Mexican illegal immigrants all kinds of rights. And no, well, it's not a crime. I couldn't believe it when I read that. In fact, I'm going to read that again. She said it. I'm just going to read it. Here we go. During the comments, the chairwoman referred to legislation and Representative James Sensenbrenner that would increase border enforcement and make illegal immigration a criminal offense instead of a civil matter. I read the legislation. It doesn't make illegal immigration a criminal offense because it already is. And I read the federal code. So lie, 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 lie. If at first you don't succeed, lie again. And that's what Debbie Wasserman Schultz is going to do repeatedly throughout this campaign. But I also feel bad for the people of District 20 in Florida. They got somebody who is going to use these kind of tactics. Oh, by the way, I'll come back to that. But she's going to use these tactics. She's going to use these tactics throughout the campaign as the DNC chair, which is a full-time job. And yet she's going to say that she's still properly representing them. They're really being shortchanged. So we absolutely need to see her go and end her political career. There's just no need for her anymore in the Congress. So let's see. Here we go. Another thing, another lie. The new chairwoman has made a number of attention-grabbing comments in an April 6 interview with MSNBC. Imagine that, MSNBC. She said the budget proposal by Chairman Paul Ryan to reduce the deficit by $6 trillion in 10 years, she said this plan would literally be a death trap for some seniors. And, of course, this article defines literally as to mean actual or not figuratively speaking. So what she's saying is this bill, what it does to Medicare, will be a death trap for some seniors. Now, I don't know. I have an engineering degree, and so I took a lot of math, Paula. I'm not really sure how taking over $500 trillion out of Medicare makes it better for seniors. But Paul Ryan's plan, putting that over half a trillion, it's like $565 billion, back into Medicare, now we've created a death trap. Yeah, all that money back in there, death trap, going to kill people. So let's just see if her numbers add up. She said, we've added 12 years of solvency to Medicare and ensured that it would be better, and it would be better for seniors. That's what she said. And we've heard all of the things that are going to happen and the rationing that's going to go on. So I don't see how that's going to be better for seniors. And in fact, what they did with that money is they put it into Medicaid to spread around the states. And we know Medicaid is – I have friends that are doctors. Medicaid is much worse than Medicare in terms of getting taken care of. That's really for the last line of defense for poor people, Medicaid. So our seniors may not be, poor, but that's the kind of service they're going to start getting. So let's see what the Congressional Budget Office had to say. It said that the Medicare Trust Fund will be exhausted by 2020 at the current path, almost a decade sooner than the last year's forecast. So she said Obamacare added 12 years to Medicare, and the Congressional Budget Office, full of accountants and it's nonpartisan, it's an arm of Congress that looked and predicted based on Obamacare and where Medicare is today that it'll be insolvent in 2020. So she lied again. I mean, the lies just keep adding up. One article full of – there's got to be at least seven, maybe eight lies in there. So Debbie, what's your next lie? Schultz, awesome. I think it's time to move on to something a little more positive. And Paula, you said that you saw quite a few articles today talking about Michelle Bachmann and her potential run for the presidency. What did you find?
Well, for those of you out there who don't know who Michelle Bachmann is, and just a little side note, I typically don't, back or verbally, you know, push for people. But, you know, when Palin was out there doing her thing and she's subliminally doing her thing now, I'm still for it. You know, she's got some views and my views are different than what her views are. And, you know, she's doing her thing. But, you know, and she's a smart businesswoman, regardless of what people think and understand about who she is. She is a smart businesswoman. But Michelle Bachmann has a Facebook page, and right now she's up to 309,000 followers on her Facebook page. So if you want to get to know Michelle Bachmann through Facebook, get on her Facebook page and like her page and follow her in what she's doing. Recently, she was elected in 2006 as the first Republican woman to be elected in the U.S. House of Representatives from the state of Minnesota. And in only her first term, she developed a reputation as a principled reformer who stays true to her conservative beliefs while pushing for real reform of the broken ways of Washington. Her strong advocacy for her constituents earned her a second term in Congress in November of 2008. She's a leading advocate for bipartisan earmark reform and tax relief and is a staunch opponent of wasteful government spending. Now, I think this is what people want to hear. She's among the leaders in the U.S. House pushing for increased energy exploration, which is something that I like and I back fully, in the U.S. to provide much-needed relief at the pump for hardworking Americans and put our nation on the path to energy independence. She currently sits on the Financial Services Committee, and the committee is tasked with the oversight of numerous financial sectors, including housing, real estate, and banking. And it gives her the keen insight into the housing crisis and the credit crunch, leading her to be a staunch opponent of the taxpayer-funded bailout of Wall Street. She's a graduate of Anoka High School, Winona State University, and after earning her law degree, she went on to the College of William and Mary to get an LLM in tax law. They reside in Stillwater, where they own a small business mental health care practice that employs 42 people. This weekend, she was in New Hampshire addressing the Dover-Stafford GOP picnic, and she discussed her potential 2012 presidential bid, Sarah Palin, and why she was in the Granite State. And when asked about timing for her possible presidential announcement, she said that they're very close, that she had just announced on Thursday that she'd be making the announcement in the state where she was born in Iowa and in the city of her birth, which is Waterloo. And she mentioned that she is looking forward to making the announcement next month. When she was asked about Palin potentially getting into the 2012 race, she said that she thought that we're going to have a very wide, deep bench of great candidates to come against Barack Obama, and that if she decided to throw her hat in the ring, she thinks that she'll do it very favorably against Barack Obama.
Uh-huh. Well, I would just like to say that anybody that does get log into Facebook to go friend Michelle Bachmann, stop by our site too.
Make sure.
I think I am a friend of, I've friended or said I liked, rather, Michelle Bachmann in the past. So I think I'm already on there. But that's impressive, 309,000 people. That's good.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good following, and I'm hoping that she can ramp it up, and I'm going to continue to, you know, follow her and listen to, you know, what she has to say, and you know what her issues are, you know, the taxes, health care, energy development, supporting the men and women in uniform, and the Minnesota values. You know, even though I'm from the state of Massachusetts, I want to hear, you know, how she's going to deal with the issues at hand, which is what I'm going to do pretty much with everybody that's going to jump on the ticket.
Yeah, very good. Well, any other stuff on Michelle Bachmann?
Not.
That's okay.
No, she went on to She showed up on Good Morning America this morning, and she doesn't consider Palin a competitor, but a very good friend.
Yeah.
You know, she compares herself to Barack Obama, but not any of the other Republican candidates. And she considers Palin a good friend, and she says that conventional wisdom is held that Palin and Bachman were likely to appeal and compete for the same voters in the GOP primary electorate. Both women were early allies of the Tea Party movement and have distinguished themselves by way of their strident criticism of Obama. They're well-aligned politically, if they both enter the race, it could put them in an awkward situation because of Palin's star power, which could well eclipse the Minnesota congresswoman. Woman, but you know, Bachman said there's plenty of room for candidates, not just for herself and for Palin.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this. When I ran for Congress and there was a woman in the race to begin with, I was told she's got a 3 or 5 point advantage over any of the guys because there's only one woman in the race. And then another woman got in the race, and that actually helped mitigate it, having two women in the race. And I've actually heard of people getting a woman into the race when there's one already to try and negate that a little bit. Somebody that gets in and acts serious, but they're not. They're just there to add another woman to the race. It's all posturing and, you know, strategy and that kind of stuff. But what I'm getting at is she's the only one and the only woman in the race. That does give her somewhat of an advantage, quite honestly. Well, that's good, because I'm looking at a picture right now of Hillary Clinton getting out of a limo. And if anybody would like to go read this article, I'm not going to go through it all, but it's on iWatch News. So if you go to iWatchNews.org, the headline is, Limousine Liberals, Number of Government-Owned Limos Has Soared Under Obama. And the excuse is, but we want to keep our diplomats and people safe. We want them to be safe. Of course, you and I, Paula, they want us to buy smart cars, which are actually dumb cars. If you live someplace and that's what everybody owns, then it might be smart. But it's a dumb car where we live in the U.S. where people drive trucks and big cars. If you ever got hit or in an accident, you're dead. And you can't take one of those on the highway. I've seen them on the highway. That is just – you might as well be on a motorcycle. And you're that much exposed, except, you know, you're in a car. And cars get into accidents, and you're gonna die in one of those cars down the highway. So you can't even go on the highway. So for our culture, our lifestyle, what we're doing, it's a dumb car. Now, there might be some people out there to own it, and they might love it. You're not in a very safe vehicle when you're surrounded by all these other heavy vehicles. The bottom line is this, though. Our president would like us to make ourselves less safe. And the CAFE standards that were put in place a couple years ago by this president under the EPA direction makes our cars less safe because the only way to meet those standards is to lighten the cars. That's one way that the manufacturer will do it. There are other things they can do to make the engines and engine systems more efficient, but that won't be enough. So they have to be made lighter, lightweight, and that's less safe. But our president and our diplomats and our secretaries of different departments, they're riding around in nice big old limos because that's what's safe. So what's good for the goose isn't good for the gander. That's one little article right there, and you can go find it there at that website. Next, this is a good article in the Washington Examiner. They always have some good articles. But the title of the article is Pro-Obama Media Always Shocked by Bad Economic News. Have you noticed that, Paula? That it's always unexpectedly. Something happens. Oh, it's unexpected. We didn't see that coming. Always. So I'll give credit where credit is due. Mega blogger Glenn Reynolds, a.k.a. Instapundit, has noted with amusement the word unexpectedly or variants thereon keep cropping up in mainstream media stories about the economy. So here we go with some of them. New U.S. claims for unemployment benefits unexpectedly climbed. Personal consumption fell when it was expected to rise. Durable goods declined 3.6% last month, Reuters reported on May 25th, worse than economists' expectations. May 19th, previously owned homes sales unexpectedly fall, says Bloomberg. May 18th, U.S. home construction fell unexpectedly in April, wrote the Wall Street Journal. Those examples are all from the last 2 weeks. Reynolds has been linking to similar items since October 2009. Let's see what else he has to say here. One answer is that the many in the mainstream media, have been cheerleading for Barack Obama. They and he both naturally hope for a strong economic recovery. After all, Obama can't keep blaming the economic doldrums on George Bush forever. I'm confident that any comparison of economic coverage in the Bush years and the coverage now would show far fewer variants of the word unexpectedly in stories suggesting economic doldrums. It's obviously going to be hard to achieve the unacknowledged goal of many mainstream journalists, the president's reelection, if the economic slump continues. So they characterize economic setbacks as unexpected. Oh, we didn't see that coming. Yeah, with these kind of policies mainly running the debt up and the uncertainty that businesses face about higher taxes, yeah, no, it's unexpected that the economy just doesn't seem to want to get out of this recession. Unbelievable. So they characterize economic setbacks as unexpected, with the implication that there's still every reason to believe that, in Herbert Hoover's phrase, prosperity is just around the corner. A less cynical explanation is that many journalists really believe that the Obama administration's policies are likely to improve the economy. Certainly that has been the expectation as well as the hope of administration policymakers. If you remember Christina Romer, whose scholarly work is widely respected, she's Obama's first Council of Economics Advisor Chairman, famously predicted that in February 2009, stimulus package would hold unemployment below 8%. Oops, not a good prediction. She undoubtedly believed that at the time, she is too smart to have made a prediction whose failure to come true would prove politically embarrassing. But unemployment has zoomed to 10% instead and is still at 9%. Let's see. Administration economists are now making the point that it takes longer to recover from a recession caused by financial crises than from a recession that occurs in a more or less ordinary operation of business cycles. Yeah, that's why. There's some basis in history for this claim, but it comes a little late in the game. Let's see. This was written by Michael Barone wrote this article. We cited the other guy as the blogger, but this was Michael Barone's article. We tend to hire presidents who we think can foresee the future effect of their policies. No one does so perfectly. But if the best sympathetic observers can say about the results is they are unexpected, voters may decide someone else can do better. I agree. And have you noticed that, Paula? Every time there's some bad news, the media, all of the media, that wasn't expected. That was a surprise, on and on and on. Every single time. Have you noticed that?
Yes, I have. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we got another piece here, and I got to tell you this. I pick on the president for his policies and the way he does things as president of the United States,
mm-hmm.
and I think he's fair game. He's a politician, and I think that's reasonable. As commander-in-chief, I have respect for the office of commander-in-chief, but I got to tell you this. I'm just embarrassed by this guy. As a career military officer, I'm embarrassed. I just find it embarrassing, so embarrassing. This article in the Telegraph here, which is a British newspaper, Niall Gardner. And so he's looking at it from a perspective of a Brit who has a prime minister that does like to play golf. And here's what he had to say about Barack Obama's decision to play golf on Memorial Day. He says it was disrespectful and hardly presidential. And this is what he's writing to his own people, his own country. So he's not talking to us. He's talking to his own countrymen. He says, "Can you imagine David Cameron enjoying a round of golf on Remembrance Sunday? It would be inconceivable for the British Prime Minister to do so, and not just because of the usually dire weather at that time of year. Above all, it would be viewed as an act of extremely bad taste on a day when the nation remembers and mourns her war dead. I can't imagine the Prime Minister even considering it, and I'm sure his advisors would be horrified at the idea. And if the Prime Minister ever did play golf on such a sacrosanct day, he would have been given a massive drubbing by the British press, and it would never have been repeated." Contrast this with President Obama's decision to play golf yesterday, Memorial Day, for the 70th time in his 28-month-long presidency. 70 times he's played golf. He has played golf now 9 weekends in a row. For tens of millions of Americans, Memorial Day is a time for remembrance of the huge sacrifice made by servicemen and women. We did a show on that yesterday. Had my dad come on. If you didn't catch the show, go listen to yesterday's show, especially the last probably 20 minutes of the show where my dad, Vietnam War hero, got interviewed, and it was a great show. So Let's see. The business of memorializing, make sure I give the right credit to this person. The story has not been reported so far in a single U.S. paper, but it was made public by veteran White House correspondent Keith Koffler on his blog. Here's what he said. The business of memorializing our war dead done, President Obama headed out to the Fort Belvoir golf course today, finding his way onto the links for the ninth weekend in a row. Obama earlier today laid a wreath on the tomb of the unknown soldier and met with families of those killed in battle, but he emerged from the day's solemnity to go golfing for the 12th time this year and 70th time in his presidency. I just find it really, honestly disgraceful. I'm disappointed, and it's embarrassing. I find it embarrassing. That's just me. And I've heard other people make that comment, other people that think it's just not a queue with some wounded warriors or meet some families in the afternoon and just go home and have a nice dinner with your family. Keep it a, you know, sort of a more of I don't know what the right word is, but more like how you would operate on, say, a Sunday where you go into church with your family and it's, you know, more of a spiritual day and that kind of thing. As commander-in-chief, he sets the example for everybody in the military, and I think he's doing a very, very poor job about that.
Of poor jobs, can I just share something with you? I wasn't sure if you had seen this.
Go ahead, please.
The former representative, Pete, I don't know if I'll say his last name, Hoekstra, who's a Republican from Michigan.
Pete Hoekstra, yeah.
Hoekstra. He says that the intelligence community takes a dim view of the president. And he said he uses the words dissent and dislike, which are common attitudes towards the president among CIA workers. He says that Obama's reversal since taking office may have triggered the backlash, who noted that Obama now supports Bush programs he'd once maligned. Representative Hoekstra says that the Obama administration has acknowledged that enhanced interrogation techniques helped get the information that led to the successful raid on bin Laden's compound. President Obama has never closed down the U.S. operation at Guantanamo, as candidate Obama promised to do over and over again. Under Obama, the U.S. has continued the policy of unlimited detentions and the use of military tribunals. He also cited Obama's extension of the Patriot Act. It no longer makes sense for Obama's Justice Department to continue investigations into the Bush-era treatment of terror prisoners, and suspects now that he has embraced those same tactics. Hoekstra was chairman of the House Intelligence Committee between 2002 and 2006.
Hey, Paul, you still there? I think
I am.
You lost me.
Nope.
Okay. Well, you know, there was one other thing that I forgot to mention in this article about the commander-in-chief, and that is that George Bush said he would not play golf, stop playing golf out of respect for the families of the Iraq war dead. Just as I said earlier, you're the head guy. You got to set an example, leadership by example. And the president, while I am not somebody who would say George Bush is the gold standard for a Republican president, when it came to being commander-in-chief, he was very well respected by the military, and he acted like a commander-in-chief. And I think that's important. So I think there are two things that a president has to consider here. One is your commander-in-chief. That's one job. And everything else, which tends to revolve around politics, and unfortunately they involve politics in the military aspect of it as well, but that's something sort of different. You know, we can argue about his policies and what he wants to do and where he wants to take this country. But when you're commander-in-chief, you need to set an example and use a little military bearing. I guess it's hard for somebody that's never served in the military, not even been a Cub Scout, to have any military bearing. But that's unfortunately what we've got here. What I wanted to play is, we never got a chance to play it, but this is David Beamer, who was interviewed shortly after bin Laden was killed because I believe he had a son who was killed in 9/11 in one of the towers. And he found it sort of incredulous that the president was so focused on himself when the groundwork that was laid for getting bin Laden was really under George Bush and his direction and his policies. And, of course, it was the military that went in and got him, and it was a difficult prospect. The president wanted to send people in to get him, and we saw that we came close to have it being a disaster with the helicopter that crashed. I know these guys are absolute professionals, but they didn't really know who was in there and what kind of weaponry they had, and they were forced to go in. They originally were going to be able to go in without anybody, I mean, really just instantly be rushing into the building. Now, with the helicopter crash, they had to regroup, and it gave the occupants of the house a whole lot of heads up. That suddenly turned the situation very, very dangerous. So something can turn much, much worse quickly when there is a problem, mishap, et cetera. Whereas the military one just blow the whole compound up. So this is what David Beamer had to say, and he said this was probably within a few days after bin Laden.
I feel some chagrin now, though, about how the rest of it's being handled. And frankly, it started May Day 2011 when the president announced to all of us what had happened. The excessive use of the personal pronoun that he used in his remarks, I really felt that was the beginning of the commander-in-chief putting too much spotlight on himself, taking too much credit for what these remarkable Americans had done. And of course, it's only now been accelerated to a greater degree in the media. You know, it's being hailed as one of the greatest wartime decisions, bold and gutsy. And quite frankly, under the facts and circumstances, I think it was anything but that. I think this decision had an inexorable conclusion. At the various decision points, as the information unfolded, were straightforward and easy, and really had no other choice.
Yeah, there we have it. David Beamer lost a son in 9/11, and that was his take on. And I believe he's also a veteran, but that's his take on the president's speech and patting himself on the back. Now, real quickly, I'm just going to throw this out. The Washington Times, I've written op-eds for the Washington Times. Here's an editorial. Obama's faithless pledge to Israel. I don't know if you heard about this, Paula, but back in 2009, the president issued a presidential determination that has been done ever since first George Bush, and that is we would like to put the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, but it's currently in Tel Aviv. And part of that is because of the terrorism coming from the Palestinians, et cetera. But every president has signed something saying, well, we're going to delay it another 6 months. And they just keep signing it. Yes, there was a law that was passed that suspension of limitations under the Jerusalem Embassy Act, a legally required waiver to continue the delay that this was originally passed in 1999. The deadline for moving the U.S. Embassy from Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Presidents have issued this determination twice a year, every year. But Obama deleted a passage in it. And here's the passage he deleted that all presidents, including Bill Clinton, had put in there. And the passage is stating that the United States remains committed to beginning the process of moving our embassy to Jerusalem. He took that out. So he delayed. He said, we're not going to move it yet. We're going to delay the order. But he did not say, but we are committed to moving it to Jerusalem. And this is just another example of why we don't believe that he is going to support Israel and certainly doesn't believe that Jerusalem should be the capital of Israel. He'd like to see Jerusalem divided. That's why Netanyahu said Jerusalem will never be divided. They own it. It's in Israel. It's going to stay in Israel, and it's going to stay the capital. So Washington Times, you can go read the whole article, but the White House has thrown the Jewish state under the bus. There's just one other example. Not only his speech that he made, but back in 2009, he started telegraphing precisely his feelings about Israel. And then finally, let's wrap it up with our friend Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney gives Barack Obama an F.
Oh, yeah. I heard about
that. Mitt, did you hear about that?
I did.
Yeah. So here's what he had to say. We'll just, quote him on a few things here. But he's giving Barack Obama an F for the last 2 years. It's failed, said the former Massachusetts governor in an interview taped in New Hampshire. He's been one of the most ineffective presidents at the job at hand that I've ever seen. The number one issue he faced when walking in the door was an economy in fast decline. He didn't cause it, but he made things worse. Yeah, no kidding. Romney, who is set to formally launch his campaign on Thursday, said he's running because I believe I can get our economy going again. Let's see what else he had to say. Now, responding to critics who question his dismissal of Barack Obama's health care plan, Romney said the difference is what is in what the bills. If I become president, I'll repeal Obamacare. My bill was 70 pages. His is 2,700, and that is true. That is absolutely true. Obamacare is full of Trojan horses, just absolutely loaded and full of Trojan horses and things that have nothing to do with health care. It was a huge pat on the back and payback for political cronyism and corporate cronyism throughout the country from the Democrats. And second of all, states have the authority to do this. States have the authority to implement a health care plan. And I'm all for states trying different things out. They have to. They need to. And it's their responsibility. But the federal government has no authority to implement this kind of a health care plan. It's unconstitutional. So there's right there. He made an attempt. He had a Democrat legislature to work with, and they didn't give him precisely what he wanted. And then even after the bill was passed, they tacked on some other things. So he didn't get precisely what he wanted. It wasn't absolutely his, just like the president. Did the president write Obamacare? Of course not. One, he's not competent to write it. But two, he didn't write a single thing in there. And how many times was he asked about something in Obamacare and he didn't know about it? Of course he didn't write it and doesn't know about it. A 70-page document, I guarantee you, Mitt Romney knew it was in it, and there might have been some things he didn't want, but he compromised like politicians have to do. The bottom line is the states have the authority to pass bills like that. The federal government does not. That's the main thing. But let's see what else he said. I guess that's pretty much it. But he did say, if I do become president, I will repeal Obamacare. The legislature would have to write the bill, and it would have to pass in the House and Senate, and then he would sign it, and that would be the end of that. When he says my bill was 70 pages, his 2,700. In those extra 2,630 pages, he's doing a lot of stuff that is just devastating the healthcare system in this country. He's wrong. And there are things in it that have nothing to do with the healthcare system. So that's... Again, that was political cronyism and corporate cronyism going on in that bill, besides their so-called reform that the CBO is telling us isn't really going to help Medicare, that's for sure. And they took over $500 billion out of Medicare, put it into Medicaid for the states, and somehow that's not going to hurt seniors. No, it makes it better, according to Debbie, what's her next lie, Schultz, it makes it better. Well, they're just lying to us. So
I
that's
lied.
The end of that. Why don't we talk about some more potential candidates tomorrow for the presidency, and if I come across any more of Debbie, what's her next lie, Schultz's lies, we'll talk about that, but I won't spend as much time on her and her lies. I think we've made the case that she has every intention of lying her way through this next campaign.
Like I said, she's going to dig herself a real deep hole. She keeps falling that path.
Exactly. Yep. All right, Paula. Well, good talking with you all the way from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And
thanks
here. Everyone for tuning in. I'll give you the final word, and I know what it's going to be.
Yeah, shout out to the troops. Your families love you and miss you and want you home very soon.
Absolutely. All right, Paula, have a good evening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.